Hello, and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk, and we are exactly 1 week away from Election Day. And actually, today we have a little bit of a surprise for you. We are going to be focusing on state-level races and ballot initiatives. So, of course, if you've been listening to us for the past year or more, you know that the biggest focus nationally is on the House and Senate. But state governments play a big role in determining the laws that Americans live by, and these midterms have the potential to shake up control of a bunch of state governments around the country. Also, when it comes to ballot measures, voters themselves are going to be weighing in on policies directly in various states, and those things range from Medicaid expansion to climate-related laws to, of course, marijuana, maybe one of the most ubiquitous ones over the past few years. And here with me to discuss all of those state races and ballot measures are 538 Elections analyst Nathaniel Rakich. Hey, Nathaniel, how's it going?
Hey, Galen, I'm good.
Good to have you in studio.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure to
You're usually down. So far away in Boston.
Ugh. Not that far.
And also with us is 538 senior reporter Anna Barry Jester. Hey, Anna.
Hi, Galen. How you doing?
Doing well. And Anna joins us from California, which takes the distinction of maybe the ballot measure capital of the nation. Anna, how long is your ballot this fall? Do you have any idea?
Yeah, we have a mere 11 state ballot initiatives, but fear not, there are plenty of local propositions in addition to those that people have to study up on. So my local one, I think, includes at least 15.
Yeah, in 2016, we actually had a listener of the podcast send us the book that they mail out in California explaining all of the different ballot measures, and it was literally like it was a book.
It's huge. It's giant. And actually, we have parties every year to go over the ballot initiatives just to understand them. They're really, I mean, some of them are really complicated, including this year. There's a couple of ones that are really important, but are super complicated and asking an awful lot of voters in terms of making decisions.
I think that's the most 538 style party I've ever heard, where you just like get some beers, read some ballot measures, talk about all the complexities and nuances of the policies. Anyway, we are going to get to ballot measures, but first we are going to focus in on state legislative races. And in case we're at any risk of boring people who think that state-level races are not worth their time, Nathaniel, can you just lay out a little bit of what is at stake when it comes to these state races?
So I'm going to make a bold claim here, which is that
it.
State races, and I'm including governors in this, so it's kind of cheating, but state races as a whole are more important than the House or the Senate. They are the most important things on the ballot this year. You can argue that, you know, who wins the control of Iowa state government is less important than who wins the House as a whole, but I think there's really no contest when you're looking at all the states together on the state level.
Why? Why do you make that claim?
So because when one party is able to take full control of a state, they are able to pass all sorts of dream progressive or conservative priorities that, frankly, we haven't seen on the national level in quite some time, really, since Obamacare in 2009-2010. And even that was, you know, fairly watered down. But when Republicans took full control of a lot of state governments after the 2010 elections, which obviously went well for them, they were able to pass laws like Act 10 in Wisconsin, as you know, Galen, you know, putting restrictions on unions. They have been able to pass things like abortion restrictions. They've passed immigration restrictions. In the few states that Democrats have control, they've been able to raise the minimum wage to $15. If single-payer health care is going to happen somewhere, I would wager dollars to donuts that it's going to happen on the state level before it happens on the national level. So the states really are not just a laboratory for democracy of things that might happen on the national level someday, but these are real policies that affect millions of people who actually live in these states. So when we're talking about state legislative races, we're talking about a party's ability to enact those laws.
Yeah, Anna, what is your experience? Obviously, you live in California, so you've been keeping your eyes on a state that has had a Democratic trifecta between the governor's mansion and both chambers of the state legislature. What have you seen there?
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting, right? Because the divide here is sort of between the more progressive liberal Democrats and more moderate Democrats. But it really changes the tenor of what is being talked about in the state legislature, right? So, you know, there have been pretty easy expansions of the social safety net in ways that you wouldn't see in a state that didn't have a blue trifecta, if you will. I've also been thinking a lot about, education is largely funded by the federal government, but those decisions are made at the state level. And, we saw a huge wave of protests in red states last year among teachers, right? And you'd expect that things like that could come up if some of the trifectas are changed. And then the other thing, of course, is with Obamacare, the Republicans have been looking to change the protections for pre-existing conditions. And a lot of those, say those went away, which is definitely a possibility. There's a lawsuit that can make that happen. There's legislation that can make that happen. A lot of that would come down to the state level to determine some of the healthcare policy, which is where actually a lot of healthcare policy is determined. So the elections are, I completely agree with Nathaniel that these local elections are really, really important.
And I'll also just say, by the numbers, if you think 435 House races is a lot, there are over 6,000 state lawmakers on the ballot this fall. So for people who like elections, there's a lot of freaking elections. So let's get into some of the specific states. But before we do that, can we kind of lay out where the starting point is? You already mentioned, Nathaniel, that 2010 was a really good year for Republicans on the state legislative level. How many trifectas have they maintained? How many trifectas do Democrats have starting out this fall?
So Republicans are in a great shape on the state level, and that is largely due to the Obama years. Democrats lost around 1,000 state legislative seats under Obama, which was the most under any president since World War II. Currently, Republicans have full control, the trifectas that Galen mentioned. So this is the governorship, the state Senate, and the state House. Republicans have full control of 26 state governments, and Democrats have only 8. But the 2018 election, by dint of being kind of one of these off-year elections where a lot of governorships and state legislatures are up, like in 2014 and 2010, Republicans have a lot to lose in those states because they did so well in 2010 and 2014. Plus, the fact that it's such a good Democratic year means that Democrats have a lot of opportunities to break those Republican trifectas and, at the very least, be able to block Republicans from passing more conservative laws. And in some states, they even have a chance to take full control themselves, and then they can start kind of their own version of what Republicans did after the 2010 election.
So let's start there. What are a few of the states that already have Democratic trifectas, and where could they expand that?
The Democratic trifecta states are some of the bluest states in the country, as you might expect. So California, of course, they've been able to pass lots of liberal laws there. Places like Delaware, places like Connecticut, although that's just barely true, they were able to pass, for instance, a big gun control law after Newtown. And then some of the places where Democrats can take total control, some of their best shots are in New York, which you would think might be already a Democratic trifecta, but there's this thing called the IDC. Democrats in the state Senate who switched parties basically to join with Republicans. So technically Democrats have a numerical majority in the New York State Senate right now, but there's a Democrat who caucuses with Republicans who keeps them from actually having control of the chamber. But Democrats are in great position to pick up a handful of seats in the state Senate in New York this year.
So is that the most likely trifecta we're looking at?
I would say either New York or Colorado. Colorado is looking good for Democrats as well. They currently have both the state house and the governorship. They're looking very good in the state house. The governorship looks like it's going to stay in Democratic hands with Jared Polis. And in the state Senate, they're just down by 2 seats, and they have lots of opportunities in kind of the Denver suburbs, places that, as we know from the House, have been swinging toward Democrats a lot. So both those states, I would say, are pretty likely to go fully Democratic next year as well. I would also add Maine to that list. Maine is a place where they currently have a Republican governor and a Republican state Senate, but Democrats are probably favored to flip both of those. But, whenever you have two parts kind of in the air, then it's a little bit less likely.
What kind of legislation could these states pass if after Election Day they actually have Democratic trifectas?
I think generally speaking, you're looking at perhaps an increase in taxes to pay for things like infrastructure, education, potentially safety net type of programs. Legislation that increases the minimum wage has been really popular in democratically held states. Environmental regulations and certainly like an increase in requirements for renewables, that kind of thing. In California, which is obviously already very blue and is going to stay blue, I feel pretty comfortable saying that, it's probably going to get more blue. And I think you are looking at a real potential push for some kind of universal health care. I think California really wants to be a breeding ground for that kind of legislation and is going to be looking to do that. Some members of the Democratic Party are going to be looking to do that sooner than later. And if they pick up a few more seats in either the House or the Senate, they're likely to get that.
Yeah, it's interesting. New York a big part of the gubernatorial primary was Cynthia Nixon railing against that independent group of Democrats who were caucusing with the Republicans, preventing the state from passing significantly more progressive legislation. So it'd be interesting to see if after this election we have, you know, both California and New York, two of the largest states in the country, kind of pushing really progressive legislation.
Yeah, and transportation was a big issue, you know, with Cynthia Nixon for sure because of the the MTA and the subway. But, you know, I think transportation and infrastructure, yeah, haven't been talked about a ton, but are probably really big issues at the state level.
Yeah, and the interesting thing about New York is that Governor Cuomo, who has been criticized by progressive like Nixon for enabling the IDC, he's gone really all in on Democrats in the New York Senate this year, which cynics might say is because he sees the writing on the wall, sees that Democrats are in a really good position to get the majority, and he wants to kind of be the leader of that group. But he's finally putting his muscle behind that campaign in a way that he hasn't before.
Are there any other states where you're watching to see if Democrats actually get that trifecta?
Michigan is a really interesting state for me. The Midwest is something that we've talked about a lot here, and it looks like it may be reverting to the mean and going back toward Democrats in a big way after, of course, voting for Trump. Democrat Gretchen Whitmer is well ahead in polls of the gubernatorial race there. The legislature is a much tougher nut to crack. It's pretty well gerrymandered by Republicans. The median district is about 9 points Republican leaning, but in a big enough wave, you know, if the national popular vote is, you know, a D+9 environment, that could fall, particularly in the state Senate. That's generally seen, I think, to be a tougher lift for Democrats. But Michigan has term limits, and a lot of those Republicans who were first elected in 2010 are now term limited here in 2018. So specifically, 11 Republicans are term limited out of competitive seats, and the party only needs to pick up 9 seats in order to win a majority.
And we're also looking at states like Illinois, Nevada, New Mexico, where Democrats would only have to pick up the governor's mansion in order to form that trifecta, right?
Right, exactly. So, you know, we've been focusing on state legislatures, but, you know, maybe the easiest place for them to get a trifecta would be to simply flip control of the governor's office in Illinois, Nevada, and New Mexico from Republican to Democratic. And Illinois and New Mexico both look like that's pretty safe bet. Nevada looks like a pure toss-up at this point.
The other thing I find kind of interesting is that Democrats are running candidates in a lot more elections than Republicans are. Washington Post said that 87% of state legislative races have a Democrat running and 78% of races have a Republican candidate. So, I mean, to your point about term limits, Nathaniel, there's also this question of just purely having a lot of candidates out there.
Yeah, like we say on this podcast often, in wave elections, a big factor is how big of a field the two parties play. And it sounds like on the state level, Democrats are playing a bigger field. So we'll see what happens there. But let's move on to Republican trifectas and see which are in jeopardy. And I'll also bring up here, for people who have been listening to the show for a while, the issue of redistricting and gerrymandering, because one of the outcomes of Republicans having such broad control over state legislatures and governor's mansions was that they were able to redistrict House and state legislative seats as they saw fit in 2011. And in states where either Democrats take control or where a trifecta is broken up, either Democrats will be able to gerrymander as they wish, or especially in states where there's split control, they're going to have to come to some sort of agreement about how they're going to redistrict. And determining who is in control in 2021, the next time we redistrict, begins now with these governor's races, with these state legislative races. So important to keep an eye on if that's a topic that you're interested in as well. Okay, let's get to those Republican trifectas. Who's in jeopardy?
So Republican trifectas in lots of states are in jeopardy. So there are states like Georgia, Kansas, Ohio, Oklahoma, where the governorship, again, could be decisive. Democrats are competitive in all those governor's races, even if the legislatures are not that competitive. So just by winning the governorship, they could get veto power over things that the legislature tries to pass. You could also see it happening in New Hampshire, which is a very elastic state, we say here at 538, so it moves around a lot. So famously, the New Hampshire State House has 400 members, which one of my favorite stats in politics is something like that computes out to 0.1% of all New Hampshire residents are members of the state legislature.
That's pretty good.
But Basically, you have a situation where the state house is quite likely to switch to Democrats, the state Senate probably, and the governor's race probably not. But still, having a fully Democratic legislature there would be big. Florida is another one. So Florida is one. When I wrote about this initially, I thought that maybe Democrats could take full control of Florida. That may have been a little optimistic for Democrats. They're looking very good in the governor's race with Andrew Gillum. I think, you know, we've covered that pretty well, that he's led in almost every poll. And the Florida State Senate is also looking quite competitive. The state house, it's a little bit tricky because the median district there is actually, Trump won it by only around 3 percentage points. So at first glance, it does look competitive and flippable. But the problem is Florida partisanship isn't always the same on the presidential level and on the legislative level. You have a lot of Cuban American voters who don't particularly like Trump, but are still loyal to the GOP on lower level races. Someone I recommend if you're interested in Florida legislative races is Matthew Isbell. He's a Florida data guru, and he put out ratings for all of the state Senate and state house races in Florida. And he put out a pretty convincing case that the Republicans are safely going to hold on to the Florida state house. But still, that's a state that's had a Republican trifecta since 1999 with only a brief interruption when Charlie Crist was an independent governor. And so it would really be a sea change if two of the three levers of government in Florida became blue.
Is that common that, you know, we think of Florida as a purple state, but on the state legislative level, it's been solidly red for 20 years. How different is the national environment or how we think of states' performance on the national level compared with, you know, state legislative races? Could you, for example, take the generic ballot and say, well, the generic ballot is about +9 for Democrats, so we're going to apply that to state legislative races?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't be quite so literal about it, but certainly the national environment does trickle down. So I think our rule of thumb for gubernatorial races is that partisanship, as defined by presidential election results, is about one third as strong in governor's races as it is in federal level races. And so I would generally apply that, I think, to legislative elections as well. You do see polls of the generic legislative ballot on the state level the same way that you see polls of the generic congressional ballot on the federal level. And generally, they have shown the same thing. You know, this is a good Democratic year. There's no surprise there. But occasionally, you do have cases where the state political environment is informed by the popularity of the governor the same way that the national environment is informed by the popularity of the president. So, for instance, in Connecticut, you have a very unpopular Democratic governor, and that's a state that, despite the national blue wave, it looks like Republicans are in great shape there. They might be able to flip the state Senate, the state House, and the governorship. So that's one of the few states that Republicans might actually be able to turn into a trifecta.
And Anna, when it comes to these Republican trifectas, what kind of conservative Republican accomplishments have these state houses and governor's mansions had during the past 8 years or so?
There's been a ton of legislation putting restrictions on abortion in different ways. There's been quite a bit of movement in sort of the right to work realm in terms of limiting the power of labor unions. And then, you know, taxes are always at the heart of this as well, right? So even this year, there's a lot of ballot proposals to limit the ability of state legislatures to tax and that kind of thing. And I think you've seen a lot of states be able to kind of keep those taxes down. And then, you know, again, going back to sort of the teacher strikes earlier this year, that has had some impact, obviously, on a lot of the legislative agenda and sort of limited spending in certain realms that people are kind of unhappy with. So I can, you know, you might imagine that there could be a backlash to that if some of the red trifectas go away.
You mentioned the teacher strikes, and actually I should have also mentioned Arizona as another state where the Republican trifecta could wash away. Obviously, that was one of the sites of the teacher strikes, the Red for Ed movement, and a lot of people think that anger over that could fuel a Democratic, you know, mini wave in the state legislature. So the state Senate is definitely looking threatened there for Republicans, and possibly the state House as well. Republicans do look like they're going to hold on to the governorship, so I wouldn't go so far as to say that would be a Democratic trifecta. But if Democrats were to pick up at least one chamber in the state legislature, that would give them a seat at the table for things like education funding.
You mentioned that Republicans could do well on the state level in Connecticut. Are there any other pickup opportunities for Republicans?
Yeah, so there are a few. Alaska is one. I know that our readers probably care deeply about Alaska and its three electoral votes. But that's a state where the Republican is favored to take over the governorship. And the state house is also a weird coalition, kind of the opposite of New York, where it's Republicans have a numerical majority, but a few of them have sided with Democrats to create a governing coalition. A lot of those kind of turncoats are in vulnerable districts, so I would say Republicans have a pretty good chance of getting a trifecta there. You also have close gubernatorial elections in Rhode Island and Oregon. Theoretically, Republicans could take over those seats and break the Democratic trifectas there. I wouldn't bet on those outcomes, but it's certainly within the realm of possibility.
So just, I mean, looking at these races broadly, how much of a fight are the parties putting up? What kind of money is being put into this? Is candidate recruitment as big of a priority on the state level? I mean, Anna, what are you observing there?
There's been a lot of talk about the number of female candidates who are running, obviously. Democrats are obviously spending pretty big this season, and you're seeing that in terms of the number of candidates they're running. Generally, there's more people of color, more women. It's a much broader candidate pool in the for the Democratic Party.
And in terms of money, these races are fueling a ridiculous amount of money. For instance, in Colorado's legislative races, they're expecting $7.5 million or more to be spent across just a handful of the districts that are going to decide control of the state Senate. Similar numbers in other states, Florida, Michigan. So the parties understand the importance of these races.
All right, let's move on to everybody's favorite topic, direct democracy. But before we do that, let me tell you that today's podcast is brought to you by Sunbasket. Sunbasket has been rated the number one meal kit by leading publications. Why is that? Sunbasket makes it easy and convenient to cook healthy, delicious meals at home, no matter how much experience you have in the kitchen. They deliver easy recipes and clean ingredients to your door with options for paleo, gluten-free, lean and clean, vegan, Mediterranean, family options, and more. Looking at the menu this week right now, an example of one of the meals that you'll be cooking is chickpea and kale stew with poached eggs and za'atar. Sounds pretty good. Everything is pre-measured and easy to prep. You can get a healthy and delicious meal on the table in about 30 minutes. Go to sunbasket.com/politics today to learn more and get $35 off your first order. That's sunbasket.com/politics for $35 off. sunbasket.com/politics. We're back, and let's talk about some ballot measures. There are 26 states plus the District of Columbia with some kind of initiative or referendum process, and all kinds of things end up on the ballot in these states, ranging from landmark legislation to relatively small things. It can be super complicated, as Anna was mentioning earlier. And according to Ballotopedia, Americans across the country are voting on 155 different statewide ballot measures this year. Anna, I'll ask you first, coming from, as we said, the nation's capital of ballot initiatives, what do you have your eyes on this fall?
Well, you know, the getting dark at 5 p.m. thing around here is really getting old. So the daylight savings, keeping that all year round in California is what I'm most concerned about these days.
Wait, how much is that a big issue? Like, how much is there a lot of spending? Are you seeing ads? Are like people really trying to extend daylight savings time year round?
I would say that it is not the big spender this year. And I think a lot of people don't really know how to feel about it because, among other things, it would require approval from Congress to make that happen. So it's not like the state can just vote on it and make it happen. And also, you can imagine it would be complicated to have half the year 3 hours apart from the East Coast and half the year 2 hours apart. But people are pretty interested in it. I mean, that's the kind of thing that gets talked about all over the country all the time. So, but there are several things I'm looking at. One of them is that there are four states with Medicaid expansion on the ballot. Three of them would newly expand Medicaid for the first time. So that's, you know, this Obamacare era thing that states were allowed to expand Medicaid up to people earning either depending on the state, it's going to be 133 or 138% of the federal poverty line. So Idaho, Nebraska, and Utah are looking to newly expand that. Montana has an initiative that would extend the Medicaid expansion there. So those are all polling extremely well and look pretty popular and likely to pass. And that's pretty interesting, right? Because we have still sort of the ongoing debate about where Obamacare stands. But Medicaid expansion has always been pretty popular. And there have been a lot of red states that have sort of refused to, the legislatures have sort of refused to pick it up. And starting in with Maine in the last election season, ballot initiatives have been a way that they've been thinking about doing that.
The states that you're talking about are not particularly liberal states, I guess, obviously, because the liberal states have already expanded Medicare. But what kind of success do progressives have when it comes to trying to pass more liberal or progressive ballot measures directly by voters and kind of circumvent those Republican governments?
Yeah, it's a pretty effective tactic, I think, for them. And I think they have started to wise up to it recently. You know, you have states, yeah, that have expanded Medicaid that never would have done so on the legislative level. And I think it speaks to the fact that when you kind of remove it from the politicians and disassociate it, people are willing to, you know, it's like when people, when you ask about Obamacare, it polls a lot worse than when you poll about, you know, the Affordable Care Act or provisions of that. And so I think that it shows that people maybe aren't as entrenched in what you assume their partisan ways are than you would think. But you do have the risk, at least when it's not a constitutional amendment, that the legislature can just turn around and repeal the law. So this happened in South Dakota in 2016. They passed a series of political reforms that the Republican legislature didn't like very much, and they just decided to repeal it, which is always, that can always happen.
Similarly, in Maine, voters voted to expand Medicaid, but that has not yet been implemented because the governor has refused to do it.
Nathaniel, what are you watching out for this fall?
So I think the most interesting ballot measures this fall center on this issue of voting rights or voting access. It's another good example, actually, of, you know, progressives going around state legislatures that normally wouldn't touch these laws and going directly to the people, because things like this do tend to be fairly popular, things like redistricting reform and creating new independent redistricting commissions. So as you well know, Galen, there are ballot measures to create independent or quasi-independent redistricting commissions in four states. That's Colorado, Utah, Michigan, and Missouri.
And actually, in Missouri, they would not be creating an independent commission.
That's true.
They would be creating the position of a state demographer who, like, that nonpartisan, in theory, I guess, state demographer themselves would draw the maps that would then be approved by
one person,
the legislature. And they would be mandated by this new law to consider the efficiency gap and, you know, partisan bias and all of these things. Interesting, I'll say, at least.
Very
interesting law. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, so it has the potential to be a very big night for redistricting reformers. Another one is in Florida. This is perhaps, in my opinion, the highest profile ballot measure. This is Amendment 4, which would restore voting rights to former convicted felons, everyone other than people who committed crimes like murder and sexual crimes. If you listen to some people, it could have the effect of completely changing the face of the Florida electorate. So currently, an estimated 21% of African Americans in Florida are disenfranchised to vote because they have basically criminal records. And this would re-enfranchise them. And this would affect 1.5 million people. And according to an estimate by the New York Times Upshot, that could create up to 300,000 new voters, most of whom would lean Democratic because they are disproportionately people of color. So, of course, Trump won Florida by a lot less than 300,000 votes. So Democrats are hopeful that this could help them electorally, in addition to, you know, believing, you know, presumably on philosophical grounds, that these people should get their voting rights back.
And what kind of polling do we have on ballot measures? I mean, in Florida, for example, I mean, do all of them get polled? Only the high profile ones? Do we know what Californians think about extending daylight savings time?
Yeah, I mean, I'll let Anna answer the question about California. But yes, ballot measures do get polled. Unfortunately, it's not as often as other races. But the Florida ballot measure Amendment 4 in particular has been pulled extensively. So in Florida, ballot measures or constitutional amendments need 60% in order to pass. And currently, it's kind of right at that threshold. So the latest poll from the New York Times Upshot has it at 60% for yes and 31% for no. So something to know about ballot measures polling is that the undecideds tend to break disproportionately for the no side of things, because that typically represents the status quo. And when people are undecided, the safe bet is usually to just default to the status quo. So that, you know, is really right on the boundary of passage. In terms of the redistricting proposals I mentioned, all of them are up by very healthy margins in the polls as well. Again, kind of demonstrating that, you know, a lot of these issues are popular across party lines, even though politicians don't necessarily act like that.
Yeah, and I'll mention that Ohio actually had a redistricting reform measure on the ballot earlier this year and passed it very easily. And one interesting thing about ballot measures is that it's not just a way, as you mentioned, to kind of get around the partisan state legislatures. They can actually have an impact on turnout, right? If they hit a particular nerve for the state's population, you know, I don't know how realistic this actually is, but strategists will talk about, well, you know, we put this ballot measure on the ballot because we really wanted to turn out conservatives or liberals in one way or another. I mean, a famous example is banning same-sex marriage through constitutional amendments in 2004. I'm curious, Anna, are there any examples of that, you know, in this cycle?
Yeah. So one of the high profile propositions in California is a repeal of a gas tax that's pretty explicitly on there to lure out Republican voters. It's not polling particularly well, so I don't know what that means about what it'll do for turnout, but that's definitely on there as a lure. I'd say in North Dakota, Democrats are hoping that legislation over marijuana legalization will lure out younger, more liberal voters to hold incumbent Heidi Heitkamp's seat. And similarly, Republicans in that state have put some immigration restrictions on the ballot. It's about making it illegal for immigrants to vote, which they're already not allowed to. So that's kind of a little bit of a weird one, but they're hoping that'll help improve Republican turnout.
What is, I should ask, the state of pot on the ballot in America this fall, as you mentioned, in North Dakota?
Yeah, I mean, there's it's in several states. So North Dakota has legalization on the ballot, as does Michigan. And then Utah, Oklahoma, and Missouri all have legislation over legalizing medical marijuana. So, you know, this is yet another year where we have many states looking at marijuana legislation. I mean, it's really fascinating when you think about where we were just a decade ago to see how many states are embracing some kind of legalization of marijuana while it's still completely illegal at the federal level. I find it's just endlessly fascinating.
And do we know how those measures are polling? It seems like when it's been on the ballot in the past, it's passed, right?
Yeah, they have a very good, pro-marijuana activists have a very good track record at the ballot box. Yeah, it's looking in good shape. For instance, in Michigan, there's been a lot of polls of the ballot measure Proposal 1 to legalize marijuana. The most recent Epic MRA poll shows 57% support and 41% oppose it.
Pot's getting popular. And there are endless ballot measures that we could touch on. As I mentioned at the top, there are 155, in fact. So we're going to begin to wrap up. And as we do, what other ballot measures should we be focused on election night? We're going to be getting all kinds of results. But what are the key ones that are going to, I guess, make the biggest impact on people's lives who live in these states?
There's one in California that's really weird, but is really important. It relates to dialysis centers. It's, I believe, the most funded proposal in the entire country, and that's largely because two of the largest dialysis clinics and pharma have been funding sort of the opposition to that. But it would essentially cap the amount of profit at dialysis centers. The reason I find this so interesting, though, is that it's actually really a roundabout way to get dialysis clinics to invest in staff. It's a proposal that was put on the ballot by a union that's been trying to unionize the workers at these dialysis centers. But it's being talked about as a way to, you know, sort of rein in healthcare costs, which is something people really care about, but it's also this sort of labor dispute in the background. And it's a very complicated legislation because, you know, the opponents say it would lead to clinics shutting down, hurting patients in the long run. Proponents say that it would bring some of the cost back to patients and improve training and that sort of thing. But that's a lot for voters to weigh. So I'll be very interested. I mean, I tend towards, you know, what Nathaniel was saying about people voting no when, you know, just sort of the default, I think is likely what's going to happen here, but it'll be interesting to see how much traction that gains.
So fun fact about that ballot measure, there's so much money behind it that anybody who watched the World Series will know this, they were able to buy national television ads. So in Massachusetts, I saw ads for this California ballot measure while I was watching the World Series.
I guess when you have 40 million people in your state, it's just worth it to buy national ads.
Yeah, and, you know, I mean, with the Los Angeles Dodgers in the World Series, there were a lot of California eyeballs there.
That's fascinating.
And there's huge money at stake. I mean, you can't really underestimate that. And also, we're talking about, you know, restrictions on the cost of healthcare is something that, you know, I think a lot of medical companies are concerned could spread. So, you know, nobody wants it to start there.
All right, Nathaniel, what other bits and pieces of ballot measures are you watching out for?
There's so many to choose from, Galen. It's like choosing your favorite child. But I would say in the vein of, you know, blue measures in red states, there are minimum wage increases on the ballot in Arkansas and Missouri. There are in the theme of voting rights, you have a pretty comprehensive package in Michigan that would create automatic voter registration, same day voter registration, no excuse absentee voting that would significantly liberalize Michigan's electoral laws. Nevada is also going to be voting on automatic voter registration. And then there are a couple of interesting environmental initiatives as well. In Arizona, a lot of money has been spent on creating a higher renewable energy requirement. And then in Washington, they're going to be voting on implementing a carbon tax.
We didn't get to all of them, and I would actually suggest to listeners who are interested in reading more about ballot measures to go to Ballotpedia, where it will list all of the ballot measures up for a vote this fall. Very useful place to go to learn more. But let's leave it there. Thank you very much, Nathaniel.
You're welcome.
And thank you, Anna.
Thanks for having me.
Well, as you said, Nathaniel, these are the most important races, you would argue, on the ballot this fall, the state legislative races. And so we will be tracking them election day, election night. You're going to be here on the live blog, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Tune into the live blog. I will try to alert people when chambers flip.
And Anna, you're going to be joining us for the live blog as well, right?
I sure will.
Next Tuesday night, 1 week from today. Getting excited. All right. My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the control room. As usual, keep checking this feed. We'll have more podcasts for you this week. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with any questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or a review in the Apple Podcast Store. When you leave a rating, it helps our rankings, which helps other people discover the show, or just tell someone about us. Thanks again for listening, and we will see you soon.